Thank you, Mike. Thank you to the rest of my brothers who have led this morning, has helped us go to God in worship. This morning, I don't have a PowerPoint, so I want you to kind of pay attention and follow along, because we're talking about a topic that is kind of sensitive. I'm going to be honest about that. It's tough because of the current culture and things, but I do need to begin, though, with a word of praise to this family. We're talking about spiritual liberties and liberty in general. And I can say, from having discussed and talked with some other preacher friends and things, this group is special because we've come together and have worked well together. I don't find factions. I'm not seeing any struggles and things with that and with anything that's been going on in the current culture and climate of such, which is very refreshing for me. And I think it's refreshing for all of us to not have to dread coming to worship together and fear of how someone's going to think or is going to be their mindset with angst and anxiety and maybe even some anger or frustration with one another. Thank you. Thank you for your open and loving hearts together as we work together as a family, as this beautiful and joined together family. I'm proud and grateful to call Central Mansfield my home and my family. But going forward, this topic is going to keep coming up, I think. And it's going to keep rearing its unfortunate and unpleasant head. And so I want to talk about this idea of liberty this morning and where we go from this. Because going forward, I have to ask and say, where does my liberty dictate my walk? Where does it direct me in my walk? That's the question I had in my head going through as I was working on putting this together. Well, when we hear the word liberty, I mean, my initial thought was, I mean, the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Kind of one of our founding ideas and our founding documents for this country. But what is liberty? Well, it's defined as the quality or state of being free. The power to do as one pleases, freedom from physical restraint, freedom from arbitrary or tyrannical control, the positive enjoyment of various social, political, economic rights and privileges. But the one I really want to dig on and utilize as the partial definition is the power of choice. Liberty is the power of choice. It's the right to choose. The right to have an opinion. It's the right to live a lifestyle that we deem is appropriate. And that's how God created us. To live and to have this freedom of choice. When the Lord created mankind, He didn't create a robot to worship and admire and glorify Him. He wanted a being to have a relationship with, who would choose Him, use their liberty and freedom to choose Him. And that has been His desire since the beginning. And when you go through and look at the Bible as a whole, you see the beauty and wisdom and power of God using that freedom of choice to help us along. Leaving His word here for us to have and to refer to and utilize when tough situations show up. Because I remember my very first lesson I was asked to give here when we started as the full-time preacher for this congregation was a lesson on liberty. That's really what it could have boiled down to. And it was something I was just questioning. I was like, man, this is not an easy first topic to bring. And I think I said in that beginning, I really wish that the Lord had just, in His infinite wisdom, had just left addendums or extra chapters and things to say, this is what you do when a pandemic hits. This is how we should behave when these specific situations arise. You know what? I was both right and wrong. He didn't give us those specific ones, but He gave us great examples and things to pull from and to utilize. So we can apply. We can apply situations that happen in our modern times and know how we should be behaving and how we should be going forward. Turn your Bibles to 1 Corinthians. Keep your finger in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and chapter 9. Because, man, you talk about a church with problems. A church with a lot of issues. A church that was definitely not a family, was not acting in unity, did not do anything, it seems, in love. If anything, I could see Paul writing this letter to them in sorrow and sadness and disappointment. That no level of pride and joy at all. Because Corinth is just ripe with problems. I mean, you look through the book, and I did as I was going through this and looking at all the things, and almost every single chapter addresses some sort of problem that this group was having. You start out with division, which is a derivative of pride. And that's where a lot of this book comes from, is a problem of pride. But then you get this factionisms, where everybody's, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Peter, I'm of Jesus, breaking into these factions and subgroups within a church. That's not how a family should operate. That's not how a body operates. He moves in to talk about their lack of spiritual maturity, how he expected them to be able to grasp the deeper things, the meat of the gospel. But instead, they're still drinking milk and water, and they're on the simple things. Things he thought they understood when he left, but apparently just couldn't get over those humps. The fact that the church had become a laughingstock in the city of Corinth, because they proudly counted amongst their numbers a brother whose sin even the Gentiles, those who didn't have a faith in Jehovah God, who worshiped pagan gods, looked at and said, yeah, that's not right. That is wrong. Why are you so proud of having him among your number? The fact that they were suing one another, both over things of the world, over spiritual matters, they were taking things that should have been done within a family and taking it outside and going to the court systems. Sexual immorality was rampant, seems, among the church. There are so many marital issues with divorce and remarriage. What is happening here? Where is the love? You get a faction of Judaizers have arose and are saying that the Gentiles needed to be circumcised, need to follow the old law and the new together. I guess Paul had thought he handled that previously as well. Apparently they snuck in behind him and causing problems for him. This duality of worshiping God and then still going to the temples and giving offerings and sacrifices and acknowledgement to the pagan gods of the region. The exploitation of the Lord's Supper. Again, going back to this division and factionisms, how everyone is treating it as a traditional meal. Some are being served, some are being denied, some are being forgotten. They've corrupted and forgotten the purpose of the Lord's Supper. This overemphasis of spiritual gifts, of all the wonders and things that had come, that should have been a blessing from the Lord, but instead were being used to divide and hurt the church. And even ending in the fact that people were questioning the resurrection, questioning Jesus and his role, his divinity. This is a church ripe with problems. But almost in the middle of the book, in chapters 8 and 9, and a little bit more, Paul devotes a lot of time to this idea of one's liberty, one's right, one's choice. Let's read chapter 8, starting in verse 1. With regard to food sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. And knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Right there is kind of the thesis idea for what's happening here, and where he kind of builds to get to chapter 13. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Knowledge, out of context, is hollow. It's like a puffer fish. It blows itself up, but there's nothing of context inside. But when you have love together, you have a strong, unified structure. If someone thinks that he knows something, he does not yet know to the degree that he needs to know. But if someone loves God, he is known by God. With regard then to eating food sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol in this world is nothing. It's Nehushtan, as we've talked about before. And that there is no God but one. If, after all, there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father of whom all things and for whom all live, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom all things and through whom all we live. But this knowledge is not shared by all. And some, by being accustomed to idols in their former times, eat this food as an idol sacrifice, and their conscience is weak. Their conscience, because it is weak, is defiled. Now, food will not bring us close to God. We are no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do. But be careful in this liberty of yours. Be careful that this liberty of yours does not become a hindrance to the weak. For if someone weak sees you who possess knowledge dining in an idol's temple, will not his conscience be strengthened to eat food offered to idols? So by your knowledge, the weak brother or sister for whom Christ died is destroyed. And if you sin against your brothers or sisters in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. For this reason, if food causes my brother or sister to sin, I will never eat meat again, so that I may not cause one of them to sin. Chapter 8 here is directly talking and dealing with food sacrificed to idols and the liberty to do so. Because at that time, some of them said it's fine. Some of them said it's not okay. They struggle with this. You get the Gentile side. Raised in a culture and ideas. You go to the temple to worship. You bring something there. You take something back home. It's not a big deal. That was their lifestyle. That's their culture. That's what they're used to. But the Jews on the other side of that, that's a huge problem to them. It's a big problem. It's against their culture. It's against their heritage. It's against what the old law said. Do not worship any other gods but Jehovah God. They had a very limited meal set, foods that they were supposed to be eating and partaking of to keep themselves whole and pure and ritualistically clean for the Lord so they could go and worship. Things that the Gentiles didn't care about. This is the ancient equivalent, you would say, to maybe masks, to vaccines, to whatever flavor of right struggle that's going on that we feel or see today. This was a really big deal. Because this was furthering a divide within this church. So many problems, so many issues, and you get one that should have been nothing. When you get down to the matters, food doesn't matter. We're no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do. This shouldn't matter. And Paul's answer, again, to this topic here is that no matter what the current flavor of issue is, this shouldn't be something that divides and struggles and causes a problem on either side. In fact, here, just for an exercise, let's replace the word food with a mask. I want to read through this with that idea. Just an example. Start in verse 4. With regard then to putting on a mask or to wearing a mask, we know that this idol, this thing, is really nothing. And that there is no God but one. After all, there are these so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth. And then just hop down to verse 7. But this knowledge is not shared by all. And some, by being accustomed to idols, to this lifestyle, this liberty that you have in former times, you wear a mask. You don't wear a mask. But their conscience being weak, feeling that they need to protect, that they need to wear these things, it becomes defiled, it becomes hurt. Now, a mask will not bring us closer to God, or not wearing a mask will not bring us closer to God. We're no worse that if we wear it, or no better if we do. but be careful that this liberty of yours does not become a hindrance. You have a right to wear one, you have a right to not. Why would we go forward and divide over something that matters not? Why would I stand so firmly on things that truly don't matter to my salvation? I'll tell you this, looking on social media, it makes my heart sad to scroll through Facebook and to see people that I respect and have looked up to being very hateful and harming towards other Christians. Making stands on things that, does it really matter? Posting flaming things, you know, spreading out all their armament on a bed with a caption of, come and take it! I dare you! Because the right to bear arms is being challenged again? How is that helping our case for Christ? How is that setting up an example for the rest of the world to see? Is that I'm focused on the things now? Or I'm focused on the future? I'm focused on eternity. Whatever the current flavor is, don't let that become your idol. Don't let that become the hill that you stand on. Does it matter to your soul? Is that going to save you? Is a mask, is a vaccine, is anything in the current culture climate going to cause your salvation to struggle? No. Not unless you make it. And that's where your focus and your heart and your study and devotion becomes directed towards. Take your eyes off God. Sure. It could cause your liberty, your freedom there could cause you to sin and cause others to struggle. And it is. In fact, Paul moves on in chapter 9 with saying pretty much chapter 8, here's a great thing. Here's something that's causing you to struggle. Chapter 9, I'm going to bring this even closer to home for you all because I'm going to, Paul, put my life into application here and show you how I didn't let my liberty, my right, my choice hurt my case and cause for Christ. Chapter 9, is, at least for me, is dictated the rights of an apostle, the rights of a preacher, the liberty that comes from someone who has dedicated their life to going and preaching the gospel, sharing it with the world. Chapter 9, verse 1, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, at least I am to you, for you are confirming sign. You are the confirming sign of my apostleship in the Lord. This is my defense to those who examine me. Remember how I mentioned the Judaizers? Well, they're not fans of Paul whatsoever. In fact, they tended to follow along behind him and say, well, he's a traveling individual, he's a traveling teacher, he's just after your money, he's after inflating his ego. You don't need to listen to what he's saying. Listen to us. We actually have your heart. Good intentions for your heart. We care. Verse 4, do we not have the right to financial support? Do we not have the right to the company of a believing wife? Like the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas or Peter. Or do not only Barnabas and I lack the right not to work? Whoever serves in this army at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat its fruit? Who tends a flock and does not consume its milk? Am I saying these things only on the basis of common sense? Or does the law not say this as well? For it is written in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. God is not concerned here about oxen, is he? Or is he surely speaking for our benefit? It was written for us because of the one who is plowing and threshing ought to work in hope of enjoying the harvest. And if we sowed spiritual blessings among you, is it too much to reap material things from you? If others receive this right from you, are we not more deserving? Paul's coming back in here and saying, we have rights and liberties as preachers, as Christians. I have a right to be married if I want. I have a right to collect some sort of compensation for the work I'm doing. I have a right to to this level of respect for my apostleship, for the proof that I am showing to you, that I have showed to you, that you know. And this is a good point where you sit back and again look at the cultural context. Why is he even bringing this up? Well, because culturally at that time, philosophers, great teachers would travel around from town to town and bring their knowledge, their expertise, and they were expected to be paid for sharing this knowledge. Whether in lodgings, whether in food, whether in financials, they were expected to be supported. They spent their life becoming an expert at this idea and this topic. They were expected to get some sort of compensation from this. And the accusations were arising that Paul is just traveling around and teaching the gospel because he wanted to score a quick buck. He wanted his great influence. I mean, we know Saul of Tarsus, his old name, his old self. He was known throughout the Jewish world as a righteous man who went and stood in fervor for the Lord, pushing that title, that agenda, that image forward. Those are the accusations that are being brought towards him. But you look at the last part of verse 12 through 18, and you see his answer to that. If others receive this right from you, are we not more deserving? But we have not made use of this right. Instead, we endure everything so that we may not be a hindrance to the gospel of Christ. Don't you know that those who serve in the temple eat food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar receive part of the offerings? In the same way, the Lord commanded those who proclaim the gospel to receive their living by the gospel. But I have not used any of these rights. And I'm not writing these things so that something will be done for me. In fact, it would be better for me to die than for no one to will deprive me of the reason for my boasting. For if I preach the gospel, I have no reason for boasting because I am compelled to do this. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this voluntarily, I have a reward. But if I do it unwillingly, I am entrusted with a responsibility. What then is my reward? When I preach the gospel, I may offer the gospel free of charge, so not to make full use of my rights in the gospel. Paul is saying, I have the right for compensation. I have the right to be paid. I have the right. I have the right to do these things, but for your sake, for the sake of my image, so that people don't come in and say that you're doing these things for XYZ reasons. He says, I've set those things aside. We know other churches were supporting him at that time. He says, I'm not going to collect money and things from you all. In fact, we know Paul worked as a tent maker to support himself through these things. Working by day in the markets, preaching in the evenings, preaching at the market at the time. He says, I'm setting aside my liberty, my rights, for your sake. It was nothing to him. It was nothing to do that. It was easy. It was better for him to do that. And built his case for the gospel, instead of hindering it and hurting it. So that's the ancient times. That's the letter. That's what we're reading. We're reading someone else's mail and looking at it and trying to bring application into our lives. So let's try to do that. Let's pull this back to me and back to our times. When he's talking about liberties and these rights and things, here's a question. When he comes out of this, do my liberties, do my rights trump yours? When do I get to the point that my needs are so much more than yours, that it overwhelms, that it overshadows it? When liberties and rights come head to head, especially within the church-like setting, a family-like setting, when I'm submitting to one to you, when we're submitting to one another, is it done out of love? Is it done because you're my brothers and sisters? Because we are family, because we love each other, supposedly love each other, Or is this being forced out of duty? Because you go to chapter 8 and it says, oh, well, I'm struggling with this deal and this notion, so you have to submit to me and my needs. You have to, otherwise it'll cause my conscience to stumble. Does your liberty trump mine? Or should I do this out of love? Is this a demand for submission? Or something done because I care about you and your soul and I don't want you to struggle and to stumble? In fact, when I was in college, I had a friend who had converted from Islam. And I didn't know the full customs, dietary customs of them. And we had him over for dinner one night. We put all the food out and he started eating. He said, wow, that's really good. What is that? And we listed off some of the ingredients. We got to bacon. He set his stuff down, just kind of scooted back and said, I'm sorry, I can't eat anymore. We didn't know. And he explained to us that culture and customs under Islam, they can't eat pork and pork products. We didn't know. Man, we were so apologetic. So apologetic, and kind of became a little bit of a running joke between us about bacon and such. But we made sure that anytime we went out with him or he came over for dinner, we made sure. No pork products. Did a little digging to find out what things, the dietary restrictions that went under this. Because he stated, his conscience, how he grew up, his culture, his heritage, it was a hump he couldn't get over yet. We gave up our liberty of delicious meat to help him, so that his conscience wasn't stumbled and hurt. How do I treat my brothers and sisters who have a different opinion over a specific liberty? Again, we would jest and play and tease him about it here and there, but we'd made sure once we knew. And sometimes if we knew in advance, we went somewhere, he ordered something or was going to, we'd tell him, oh, can't, don't do that, it's got XYZ in it. And every time he thanked us, because he knew we were looking out for him. I haven't talked to him in years. I don't know where he sits at right now with that, those ideas and that culture and that heritage. But I'll tell you this, if he ever comes and sits at my table again, I'm going to make sure and find out what he can and can't eat. Because I don't want to cause him to stumble and struggle because I have a right. And you should honor that right. That's not a living Christian attitude. That's not what submitting to one another is. It's not a force. It's something done out of love. It's done because I care. And lastly, how does my treatment of my said liberties affect my case for Christ? Just imagine what it would have looked like if on social media, instead of hundreds to thousands of Christians posting, how dare the government tell me how to live my life? How dare they do these things? How dare? It was, this isn't a struggle for me. This isn't an issue. I can do this to help other people. Now, granted, if you have a medical thing, that's whole different subject, whole different topic. But how hard is it really to wear a piece of something over your face for an hour, maybe 2 hours, while you're out amongst the general public? How hard is that? It's not. Why is that a hill that we or so many other people had to die on, it seems? Still do. How is that helping your case for Christ when people in the world see that or stumble upon it? Well, they proclaim to be a Christian, but yet what I'm not seeing is not love, it's not grace, it's not mercy. It's a boastful standing up for something that doesn't matter spiritually. I think all this really culminated in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I do not have love, I'm a noisy gong or clanging cymbal. And if I have prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge and have all faith so that I can remove mountains, but I do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away everything I own, and if I give over my body in order to boast, but do not have love, I receive no benefit. Love is patient, love is kind, it is not envious, love does not brag, it's not puffed up, it is not rude, it is not self-serving, it is not easily angered or resentful, it is not glad about injustice, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Love never ends. Hop down to verse 13. And all these three things remain of faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. Going forward, when I look at my liberties and my rights, if I'm not behaving in a manner that does not speak of love, of imitating Christ in a proper manner, what is my faith in my life but a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal? What is my example, all the knowledge and information I have, everything that I could bring to share the world about the gospel, but the things that I say and post, the way I handle myself, does not show love and compassion, it becomes nothing. I receive nothing from that. No benefits. John has some more good comments to make here about this idea within the family. In 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4 and verses 16 through 24. 1 John chapter 4 and starting in verse 16. Says, and we have come to know, to believe, the love that God has in us. God is love. The one who resides in love resides in God, and God resides in him. By this, love is perfected with us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because just as Jesus is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love. Perfect love derives out of fear, because fear has to do with punishment. And the one who fears punishment has not been perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. If anyone says, I love God, and yet hates his fellow Christian, he is a liar, because the one who does not have love, the one who does not love his fellow Christian, whom he has seen, cannot love God whom he has not seen. And the commandment we have from him is this, that the one who loves God should love his fellow Christians too. Whatever side of the aisle you fall on, with how you choose to use your liberties, make sure you're doing it out of love. Make sure you're coming out of respect for one another. Sit down and talk. But always come down and remember that we have a unifying foundation, a unifying belief. Jesus is God. Jesus died for our sins. And if that can't unite us, if that can't be the starting place, are we really a family then? Are we really a group that could come together and worship as one? Or are we going to be no better than the group in Corinth? Full of anger, strife, dissension, problems, and an embarrassment. An embarrassment for the cause of Christ. I hope this has been encouraging and thought-provoking. This is something, again, that I just see it struggles, and it's causing me to struggle. Because there are so many people that I look up to and respect that I'm questioning what's the motive? What's the reason? How are you helping your case for Christ? How are you showing the world that we're changed, that we're different, that our focus isn't on the now? It's on the future. It's on eternity. Think about those things as we interact in the world. And we go by day by day. If you need to make your life right with the Lord in any way, we give you this chance now as we stand and as we sing.